name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is the second episode of How I Learned to Love Shrimp, which is a new podcast about effective ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
And today we speak to Dave Komen-Heidi from Sharpen Strategy about a few different things, mainly his background and how he ended up being the president of the Humane League and how he ended up scaling this organization to a global level with over 120 staff. We also speak to him about this age-old debate of welfare versus abolitionism. And finally, we touch on what he's particularly excited about in terms of new strategies and methods for the animal advocacy movement. So yes, please enjoy the episode and do share if you find it interesting. So hello, welcome everyone. So now we are talking with David Komen-Heidi, who for over the last decade has been running the Humane League and is now a partner at Sharpen Strategy, working to advise the animal movement. So welcome, David.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Really happy to be here, James and Amy. Thanks.
Thanks for being here. So first, do you just want to talk us through kind of who you are, what you're doing at the Humane League, and how you ended up where you are?
Sure. So I guess my journey begins quite a long time ago, like in high school. I left my high school in 10th grade to go to a local community college where I was really focused on philosophy and politics. And that's where I first came across Peter Singer's work, went vegetarian, became really involved, and became the president of my political group on campus. And I ended up going to college for politics as well, really thinking I wanted to end up in kind of campaign advising. But after some experience on political campaigns and doing other kinds of advocacy work, landed on wanting to do kind of like nonprofit and corporate campaigns and public advocacy work, and got a job pretty much right out of school opening up the Humane League's Boston office. So back then it was just like a local group in Philadelphia, Aaron Ross's group in Baltimore as well, which joined up and became part of the Humane League shortly after I had joined. So that was my first years, which was doing kind of like local grassroots organizing and some local cage-free campaigns on college campuses for the Humane League in the Boston area. And then from there, we kept expanding into new cities, eventually became a national group and then an international group. So a lot of different phases during my time at THL where we, you know, broadly just started to shift from doing mostly what kind of outreach and education work towards institutional campaigns and really with a strong focus on corporate campaigns, trying to get big companies to make policy commitments that will impact animals and reduce their suffering on factory farms.
Amazing. Such a journey, I guess, right from the beginning and spanning, you know, right across that decade. A really fascinating journey for you, I'm sure, which we're excited to unpack. And do you want to tell us a bit about what you're doing now? So how that transition from, you know, running the Humane League for those that decade and now through to the consultancy that you have now?
Yeah, I decided to leave THL, I don't know how long it was now, maybe 18 months ago or 2 years ago, something like that. Really having felt like the skills that helped me grow THL from a really small group into a large group, you know, by the time I left, it was, you know, over 100 employees in multiple countries. I feel like the skill set for the early phase is very different than the skill set for kind of administering a large multinational group. It's not really where my kind of passion and skills lie. And I do think, you know, a big part of leadership is kind of understanding when it's time to step back as well and let other people have a crack at things. And I do think that there really is a problem in the nonprofit sector generally, and in animal rights, you see this a lot too, of like founders or early leaders sticking around, probably overstaying their welcome because of this, like, this change in the needs of the organization, not being noticed by the people in charge. And I also just feel like, you know, I was there since I was like 21 years old, 33 now. And that was, it's just like, it was time for a new chapter. So for many reasons, it took a while to transition. Luckily I had Vicky Bond, who was my colleague who's running the UK office, was able to take over in the US. She's incredibly competent and has a much stronger skill set for the needs of the org right now. So I wanted to take the kind of lessons I'd learned in scaling up the Humane League and bring them to other groups in the movement who are in a similar position to where THL was maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago. So these are things like focusing on, you know, organizational health, planning for growth, strategic planning, fundraising, Just sharing a lot of the mistakes that I had made over the years as well in itself is quite helpful. So I've been partnering with Andrea Gunn, who is the executive vice president at the Humane League with me. And we've started outreach and supporting a lot of groups. Thankfully, we're supported by Open Philanthropy. So this is all kind of pro bono right now for organizations that we're working with. That's the idea, is to basically help the growing movement succeed, help organizations that are having a big impact in their region successfully expand, because it's all too often you see groups have a lot of early initial success with a small team. They receive some funding and some attention, and just the pressure of growth can really dramatically shrink the impact potential of the org, cause conflict, cause the good people to leave, so on and so forth.
Nice. I do find it interesting you mentioned that. I do find it it'd be somewhat surprising if the person who started an organization was the best person to continue that for like the next 10, 20 years. I do find it quite surprising that the founders do tend to stick around for a long time, even though many, many amazing people could run big organizations. I think it's quite a brave leap. So yeah, that's really great you did that. Maybe we can chat, go straight into because it kind of came up, the running a big org topic. It seems like something that is maybe particular about you or the Humane League is that, like you said, it's really big now. It's a huge global organization, over 100 people. And in a way, it's somewhat held up as like the beacon for some really successful animal advocacy. So in terms of one thing you mentioned there was, like, you said you made some mistakes along the way that you don't want others to pick up on or like repeat. Do you want to touch on a few of those mistakes and how you try to help others avoid those?
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess because it's such a long period of time and so much rapid growth over that time, I think about like the kind of different phases in the life cycle of a growing group. You have kind of like the early days where it's just a few people and it's more like being in like a band or something almost, where you have these like incredibly close relationships with four or five people. Everyone is kind of doing everything, So like we just are all, it's very DIY. Everyone is playing every role. We all have like complete perfect information about what every other person is doing. And this compared to the end state of, like 130 people all around the world, it couldn't be more different. And there's all these steps along the way, you get to 10 people and all of a sudden you lose the ability to just like have a very tight relationship and knowledge about what everyone's doing all the time. You start specializing. Then you get to 25 people. And again, like all the systems break down, internal communication becomes a big challenge. The operational needs of the organization are quite different and challenging. Then you get to 50 people, then you start expanding internationally. Each one of these stages, I feel like I failed to anticipate how challenging it would be getting to that next step in many ways. So it's very hard to kind of give too many specifics, other than I'll say just thematically, like planning for growth is just one of the biggest stumbling blocks that I struggled with, that I know. It's just growing is very, very difficult, even if you do plan for it. And I think they're just is not enough thought put into what the next stage of the group is going to look like and what the needs are going to be. So for example, like very commonly what I would do, what I see groups doing all the time, is you have a program that's working well, you're excited about it, there's funding available for it. So you get funding to hire like five more people to participate in this program. And what you fail to anticipate is like, okay, who's going to manage like the payroll needs of those people, especially if they're in another country? Who's going to onboard and train them? Do the managers for them, who are really good at this program, know how to manage people? And do they know how to delegate the work properly to what they're doing? And that's just like a microcosm of like, the effects of all of these decisions that result from growth. So I think that is the biggest theme that we're trying to pass on to the groups we're working with. I also think another thing that I really struggled with as a leader of the group was kind of giving up the work itself, I think, is really challenging. So for me, like my passion was always doing the campaigns. Like I love pressure campaigns. I like corporate outreach. For me, this was a huge part of the excitement of the job. And I think an early mistake I made was doing that work myself for too long because I enjoyed it and not. Yeah, realistically, there are people on the team who were better at the, specific components of the job than me. And I was just holding on to it out of enjoyment, essentially, or out of like, just resistance to change, not wanting to give things up, fear of delegation, all these common things. So I think that's something that is very, very common, is that, you know, and again, this actually points to what we were talking about before, the difference in kind of skills between what's needed at the beginning of a group and like after growth, where at the beginning, you need someone who has a very like DIY mindset. I'm willing to go out and learn how to do the taxes. I'm willing to go out and learn how to set up a website and do all these things and actually like execute things, hold myself accountable, is so different than the skill set of like, I'm really good at delegating things and managing people. It's like, it's, in fact, it's probably like negatively correlated, these two personality types. So I think that's something I really regret, was like, even though I enjoyed it and it was a lot of fun, I think I held on for too long, is one key example that I think I see echoed in organizations everywhere.
I can definitely, yeah, definitely imagine that, especially being involved from so early on. Was there a moment that you knew or kind of felt that this like baby that was yours and those other early members of the team knew that initial phase of it changing from this thing that you felt like you had a lot of control over into something that was growing? And at that moment, if that isn't identifiable, do you feel like it was always a case of wanting the growth? Or was there some sense of like, actually, what if we just did stay as this kind of core team of like 5 or 10? Like, was that attractive at that time to not be focused on the growth?
I think it was definitely kind of like 1,000 incremental changes rather than some specific moment. But there were, some of the kind of key inflection points were like the first time we received a big grant from OpenPhil. So we had been at about, I don't know, $400,000 maybe, and we're kind of $400,000 to $500,000. And we were just like a bunch of local groups combined together as the Humane League. But we were each kind of like a mini nonprofit in a city, because we were doing our own fundraising, doing our own campaigns locally, our own leafleting, and so on and so forth. And this was a time of transition to becoming more of a national group. And we got, we brought on Michelle as our first full-time fundraiser. And that year we were able to raise $1 million. And we got then a grant from OpenPhil for another $1 million over a few years. But this essentially ensured like, wow, we can really hire like a professional staff now. We can start running national campaigns. We can really scale up what we were doing. And I do, it's a very complicated mix of emotions, because you are losing that feeling of like being in a band or whatever, of like, oh wow, this is like, I've got my tight crew of people and it's so grassroots, and we're like driving around with Warped Tour, doing outreach, living out of a car and eating beans out of a can, and it's like this romantic vision of like doing activism. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, now I'm in the business of like, you know, working with lawyers to put together our HR policies and so on. And this is a rude awakening.
When was this? So like, when did you join as a paid staff, and when did you get this big million? Then what's the timeline for all this?
Let's see. I joined in 2010. I want to say 2016 is maybe when we got the first OpenPhil grant, somewhere around there. I do think, you know, a common pattern you see is you get the initial funding for expansion, and it's like you're in the super high of like, wow, my dreams are coming true. But then the reality sits in and it's like, oh my God, this is like so stressful. Like, I'm now accountable for so much responsibility. Hiring all these people, training them, carrying out the work is very stressful. So there is like mourning for what you lose as an organization grows. And this is another key challenge with growth, is how do you keep an organizational culture? You know, it's very easy to have a coherent culture when you're like 5 friends who all started the work together because you have so much in common and you're excited about the strategy together. Then all of a sudden you're hiring people who may not know any of you, might come from a totally different perspective and have a different, you know, philosophical basis for why they work on animal rights and so on and so forth. And it's really quite challenging to keep that cohesion through growth. It's, you do lose a lot as you grow. It's a sad fact, but it's necessary. So, you know, the trade-offs are worth it.
Yeah. Having been someone who also traveled around the country eating hummus and beans out of the back of a car, I can attest it is pretty fun. So yeah, I can see why you'd mourn that. For me, I'm really curious about like what it actually means to be like the president or running an organization like THL, which is really big, 120 staff. So when you get to that kind of level of size and organization and kind of complexity, like, what does your day-to-day look like? What are you actually focusing on like on a week-to-week basis? And what are the key things on your desk every day?
Well, I think some of the core responsibilities are really kind of thinking about the vision and strategy of the organization and making sure that the leadership of the group, like the leadership team and the staff, that you're communicating with them about that vision and strategy, that you're getting their feedback on it, and then you're kind of like kind of painting that picture for everyone of what you'll be doing. I think this is kind of like a core responsibility of leadership that you have to be setting aside enough time for, to be communicating enough with staff and leadership and really making sure that everyone is moving in the same direction. So this is like the number one thing you need to be thinking about when you wake up during the day. But that aside, in terms of like what the actual day-to-day is looking like, it's cyclical and every day is really different. So it's a job where you have to be able to switch very quickly between, all right, I'm like at a conference, I'm meeting with major donors and, you know, pitching our next year of work or covering our annual review. Then all of a sudden you're like doing check-ins and managing your staff. You're doing, you know, podcast interviews, perhaps like you're talking to media, all sorts of things. So, you know, there's kind of like a quarterly board meeting cycle. There's the annual fundraising calendar you're looking at. So the end of year, you're very focused on fundraising. Beginning of the year, you might be more focused on like, you know, establishing the budget and the strategic plan throughout the year. So it's like month to month is going to be really quite different in what you're looking at. And it's really about like where you're at in the calendar, where you're at with like the big campaigns and that kind of thing. I think an area where it's easy to get tripped up is like just not allocating your time correctly. And I think that this is like a very key skill that I had to develop and where I made a lot of mistakes early on. And this is related to like not delegating enough of the actual work, is just focusing too much on the wrong things. Cause there's always going to be like 10,000% available of your time that you could like demands on your time. And you just need to be able to say no to the right things and make sure you're delegating to the right people, so you can focus on what you need to.
You spoke a lot about spending a lot of time for communicating the vision, but I guess also that involves setting the vision. So I was curious, how did you actually decide that? How do people at THL decide the 3, 5, 10 year vision? How do you guys decide to go take THL from a national organization to a global NGO and set up Open Wing Alliance? Yeah, how did it all come about and who did you work with? And yeah, if you can explain that a bit more, it'd be great.
Yeah, the Humane League is a very collaborative organization. So we try to see ourselves as a component of the overall movement that we work within. So for us, a major piece guiding our strategy every year or a few years was how can we contribute the most in our role within the movement. So within the US, that meant, you know, there's a large number of groups that work on the kind of corporate campaigns programs that we do, or even in the early days outreach. So we'd always kind of want to shape our strategy around conversations with them and workshops with them to make sure we're kind of contributing towards a shared goal. And that was also what informed our international expansion as well. We only really expanded into places where we thought having a group like the Humane League in that region would be quite helpful and not duplicative of other work. But mostly we focused on kind of expanding campaigns through the Open Wing Alliance. So not THL opening new offices, but rather bringing this vision of a shared campaign to other organizations and giving them grant funding and training and that kind of thing. But on a year-to-year basis, there was, you know, many people contributing to the strategy, both all the experts within THL staff and leadership team, but also, you know, the leaders of other organizations. And we would use opportunities like the Open Wing Alliance Summit to kind of get feedback and gather information on what kind of like regional campaigns should be run, what kind of global campaigns should be run, where more resources were needed, that kind of thing.
Cool. So, okay, let's move on swiftly into, I think, the juiciest topic maybe we'll cover today, which is the age-old question within animal advocacy, which is, should you support welfare work or should you be an abolitionist? And maybe, Dave, do you just want to explain what those two words actually mean and what the two perspectives maybe behind that question are?
I think that this debate echoes what you see in a lot of political and social movements, where you have on one end the kind of the pragmatists and the incrementalists and the people working in the system, and then on the other hand you have the kind of absolutist or radical folks who want to create change from outside the system or don't want to compromise or don't want incremental change. So it's very common and expected to see these kinds of divides in movements. I think historically within this context of the animal protection or animal rights work, the specific definitions really began, I don't know, over like maybe two decades ago or something. And essentially it was the so-called abolitionists who essentially think any work that is kind of like incrementally focused on reducing animal suffering is in fact not helpful. It makes the public feel better about the consumption of animals or the use of animals. We need to focus
on like
cage-free, completely abolishing their use.
But
yeah, precisely. Right. So the cage-free would be, it's like selling out your kind of like working with industry to make people feel better about the central issue, which is the use of animals. And on the other end would be the pragmatists who are really focused maybe on these like the short-term goals of reducing suffering.
So-called pragmatists, right? I think it's a bit debated who's pragmatic, who's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why I find the framing of this debate, I don't find it to be very helpful, because really it's like you could sit on either end kind of politically or philosophically and be a pragmatist or an absolutist. So I don't, you know, I don't think it's really a very helpful framing if we're thinking about like seriously discussing strategy, because I think that there's plenty of folks on like the radical side of things or the grassroots advocacy side of things who I think are very thoughtful and who are thinking about long-term strategy and are kind of excited about a step-by-step plan to get somewhere. And just like there are folks on the pragmatic side who I think are a little too short-term in their thinking and not really concerned about how to build up a powerful movement. So, I wish the movement could kind of get past this kind of like traditional us versus them. I do think it has gotten a lot better. I mean, 10 years ago, it was way, way, way worse. And I think, in fact, you know, I'll say like, I'm really glad that the grassroots side of the movement in particular has just become so much more focused on activism. And I think that's like a lot to credit to, you know, groups like DXE or, you know, the many kind of spin-off organizations, or I feel like that side of things has become very focused on like, how do we create more activists? How do we train them in skills? How do we get them to get media attention? Like these are all serious strategies, I think. And I think previously it was just a lot of kind of internal warfare about, you know, let's critique what other animal groups are doing, which is not very productive. I think that's probably exactly
but
what
it is
our,
easy.
Our, it is easy. You know, that's true. And it feels good.
Yeah, interesting. I feel like did you ever feel like as a leader of such a big player in this in the movement in the farmed animal space, did you ever feel like you either personally or as an organization had to kind of pick a side? I know you spoke previously about the culture change and that being inevitable with growth. And do you feel like THL, it's important to have kind of like a mix of both sides, or if THL is in a particular camp, and how integral or important is that to how the organization grows and how the culture is shaped within that growth?
Yeah, I think very early on, it did feel important to like kind of stake out a side. And, you know, these days, it's like the corporate campaigns have been ascendant for so long and are like the most funded thing by a wide margin. It's what a huge number of groups are doing. But if you go back in time to 10 years ago, they were extremely unpopular. I mean, it, for the Humane League's like local organizational work, we would have to do all the kind of like vegan stuff to kind of like gain popularity, gain volunteers, gain donors. And then we'd have, that was like the price we would pay to be able to do the hated cage-free things that only a few people really support.
Right.
And this bred, I think, a lot of kind of defensiveness with myself and probably some of the others, that we really had to constantly justify what we were doing, that it was morally okay, that we weren't, you know, in bed with the enemy and so forth. So it's funny now, just like the total reversal of this state of affairs. And I think that, yeah, I was definitely very sucked in by that for a long time, that debate, and feel very personally annoyed by the claims that we were, you know, sponsored by industry or disingenuous and wanting to help animals or sellouts or something. Because back then, I mean, most of the people working on the cage-free campaigns came from radical activism of some sort, or, you know, radical advocacy. This is not like I left my job doing like, you know, consulting at McKinsey to go do cage-free campaigns or something.
So this is like people you knew with Animal Movement, you kind of work with, who were kind of saying these things to you? Like, where were these kind of like critiques or attacks coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I had people interrupt my presentations in Boston, you know, and like, you know, do walkouts and accuse me of hurting animals and these things. And it was very, yeah, very common back then. And it, like the Animal Rights Conference back then was so contentious. I mean, you weren't even like allowed to really talk about welfare.
So this is like, again, like 2015, 2016 kind of period?
And earlier than that, maybe like 12, 13, it was kind of like the height of, I mean, they had a debate with like Gary Francione and Bruce Friedrich at one point. So this was like, imagine having an Animal Rights Conference where like the keynote centerpiece attraction is like two of the famous leaders like debating each other. And people were literally like cheering one side or the other during this debate. I mean, it's like, it's a tragedy to imagine.
Wow.
Yeah, that is so sad. God.
I think the second part of your question, though, Amy, I think it's important, regardless of whether it's a group like THL that's doing the corporate work or a grassroots organization, I do think it's important culturally to have this mindset of like humility and collaboration with other groups, even if they're doing really kind of different, taking a different approach to activism. And just being open-minded. I mean, I think what you see is people just form these identities around like, oh, I'm like an EA animal person, or I'm like a radical animal person, or I do the corporate campaigns, or I'm a sanctuary person. And the more that that becomes your identity, I think the more closed off your mind comes to being able to change your strategy to give up, look at evidence and say like, oh, maybe I should try this other thing, or maybe we should, you know, redirect funding from this area to another area. It's much better to hold those beliefs quite lightly and to think like, you know, I'm just an animal person. I work in the movement. Today I'm doing corporate campaigns. Maybe the strategic needs in 5 years are going to be totally different, and that's okay. And just like, you know, the easier said than done, but just like the more we can just build these friendships across these different parts of the movement, I think just the healthier it will be and the more seriously we can have conversations without it being about personal identity.
Yeah, I think on that topic there's a good blog post my friend Aiden wrote on the PAX Fauna blog, which I recommend checking out. And basically it's about his own journey from what you might call a rabid abolitionist. So he used to organize for direct action everywhere. And I think he has one particular story when someone from the Humane League came to his university to do some outreach. And just as soon as he heard that she was from THL, the only thing going through his mind was like, oh, welfarist, how dare she? We need total animal liberation. Like, what is she thinking? But then since then, he's come around and wrote these beautiful two blog posts on basically that idea that you said before, Dave, that like welfare establishment is obsolete. Most people want to change things incrementally, whether that means banning foie gras then fur, or cage free then other broiler reforms, or other chicken forms, so on and so forth. So either way, there's incremental steps. It depends how you kind of want to go about it. So it does seem like this whole debate both hasn't been that useful, and like you said, it's probably lost us like years of goodwill or like infighting. And yeah, would you roughly agree with that?
Yeah, totally. And I think overall this is an encouraging sign. I mean, I see this kind of internal warfare, to me, this is my theory I have, is kind of like a symptom of a completely powerless movement. Like essentially, if you feel like the movement can't achieve anything serious, you're just kind of left to arguing about philosophy and theory. And it's not about, and this is like, to me, a key indicator of the kind of bogus arguments that you would hear a lot 10 or 15 years ago, was that it was just not even trying to engage with like, how would this be like that early stage of the abolitionist movement. It's like not even trying to engage with what would you do. It's the best that it can come up with is like, well, we're just going to do like vegan advocacy. Like, I mean, this is just not a very impressive strategic brief on what to do. And I think that as the movement has become more sophisticated and has kind of gained a little bit of traction in various areas, has like gotten serious media coverage, has gotten serious campaign wins, has passed laws, has grown internationally, I think it frees people up a little bit to, I don't know, maybe think in a more positive direction about like, okay, what can we accomplish next? What can we do next instead of just this kind of navel gazing that is so tedious and unproductive?
Yeah, 100%. Maybe James, did you have a particular camp that you arrived at the movement in? Do you feel like you were, anything convinced you like one way or the other?
Yeah, good question. For those who don't know, I also read a bit of Gary Francione's early work, and I think he was the key proponent of this, like, really, I think his book was actually called Animal Rights and Abolitionist Approach. So he was like one of the key kind of proponents of abolitionism, saying, yeah, anything else, it's not doing justice to animals. What we should be asking for is pure, like, end of all animal exploitation. So pretty hard line as far as it goes. And obviously you read that and like, it sounds good. You're like, yeah, we shouldn't be asking for like moderate reforms. Like, yeah, like we shouldn't be legitimizing the industry and all this kind of stuff. So like morally, it felt good. And when you just like kind of get involved early on, you're a bit of an angry vegan. It's like, oh yeah, this feels good. But then also you're in that bubble and then everyone else thinks the same way. Then you're just like this small group hating this other group or like hating. So yeah, but definitely things change over time. I think over time I've been a bit more cognizant of that. It's unlikely that any, like you can't really be confident in any of these approaches. Kind of like what Dave was saying, we probably need like a variety of ways to make change. We shouldn't be that confident that any of these two approaches are particularly right. And yeah, rather than spending all of our energy on internal politics, we should actually be trying to do something and create change in the world rather than just like being angry. And also just like trying things out. If we think vegan outreach is the way to go, let's try to do it. Did it change the world? It's not looking so good. So now after that, it's probably good to reevaluate and be like, okay, we should try something else. So yeah, I think I've definitely come around to them. I don't know. There's a bit of truth on both sides. We need a bit of everything. But yeah, who knows? What about you, Amy?
Yeah, interesting. I feel like same kind of angry vegan journey and then just exposure to the Humane League and going through the interview process for working for the org.
Was that one of the key questions? Are you a welfarist? And yeah. You say yes, and then you're in.
Well, I guess not, because I think at that time I would have said no. So maybe wouldn't have got the job. But I think, the pragmatism, Vicky Bon now, the president of the Humane League, in those leadership meetings in the UK, really convincingly just bringing that pragmatism to the conversation. I actually lost a friend by joining the Humane League. I was doing corporate relations, going to the meetings with Nestle and working really closely with Aaron, and she just couldn't comprehend in any way how I would go to a meeting with, you know, the devil on the other side and those that were, you know, were harming the animals, and really just couldn't come to terms with me doing that job and being in the room with the enemy. So it's definitely still, it's heated.
In terms of future things with animal movement, what are you particularly excited about, Dave, in terms of strategies to help animals, whether it's welfare, whether it's whatever you want? What are you most looking forward to or keen to try out?
Let's see. Well, I think first I would say that I really agree with the comments you just made about the kind of combined arms approach that we should have. Like, I don't think that it's correct to just take this maximizing approach of looking for the best strategy and then put all of our resources into that. I think it's really about looking at the various kinds of strategies. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you can split this up, but you could think about like, there's like the public sector stuff of like doing politics or lawsuits or things like this. Then you've got like the private sector with the corporate campaigns and scaling up meat alternatives and corporate responsibility stuff and investor outreach. And then you've got like education, media, documentaries, public opinion shift kind of stuff. So these are like three lanes you could divide things up to. And then I think you take something more of a maximizing approach. Like, what would be the kind of optimized version of each of these kind of elements? And how do we make sure they're working together well? So to me, this is what's most exciting, is like this kind of more grand strategy question of like, what should we be doing here? What's the right carving up of resources here, and what's like, just doing more experimentation in each of these areas. So that's probably what in general I think about. But in terms of some specific stuff, I'll say that I think I am probably unusually excited compared to most people about political work in the US. I think that building up a strong political movement, I mean, I'm excited about it everywhere, but that's, you know, where I live and I think about mostly politics. So that's something that I think is underserved right now in the movement. It's under-resourced, not enough happening. Like, there are some little pockets where cool stuff is happening that to me are a nice like proof of concept, but that's something I'd like to see scaled up considerably.
What do you mean by political work exactly? What does that actually look like in practice?
Yeah, well, It could look like a lot of things, but I'll say, I think for starters, having local voting blocks and political organizations, like we have a group here, I live in New York City, in Brooklyn, there's a group called VFAR, Voters for Animal Rights, that is like the local group. And they do things like send out questionnaires to all the politicians who are running and ask them, like, do you think we should ban mutilations without painkillers? Should we ban putting animals in cages barely larger than their body? And so, you know, we've got a lot of issues that are like slam dunks, you know, where if you're talking to someone who's running for office and they're not like actively employed by a factory farm, they're probably going to agree with us on it. So to me, this is just like, it's so impressive what they've been able to do, just getting all of these candidates to agree to so many of our issues.
Mm. And people are actually agreeing. They are kind of saying, yes, we'll support this.
Yeah. Oh, big time.
Oh, really?
Big time.
Wow.
And they have a voting block. They'll say, like, you know, we have animal people who are activists who can go out and knock on doors and do other things. And like, this is not rocket science, like a million other movements and cause areas and industry groups have done this. And we're just leaving a lot of influence on the table. And this is something where I think the grassroots power that the animal movement has is really underutilized. You know, we are similar to a cause like, say, abortion or gun rights, where we have something called intensity of preference, where for the people who are animal people, this is their issue. Like, it is not just one of a million issues. It's just like, think of all the people you know in the animal rights movement. Like, this is not like one of 10 movements that they're in. Like, they are focused on animal rights. They will knock on doors. I mean, hell, they'll chain themselves to slaughter equipment, right?
So like, they'll do much more than that.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, that kind of thing would be just like step one. Like, we should just be doing that in every major city.
Mm. So you mean like have one group who's kind of contacting all the politicians, trying to get them to kind of say their policy preferences, and then basically on the best kind of candidates, get the animal... all animal people in the city basically canvass for them and try to get votes kind of to the most animal friendly person. Is that kind of vaguely what you're quite keen to see?
That would be, yeah, that's certainly a big part of what local groups can do. I mean, there's all sorts of things though. You can do local ballot initiatives in some cities. You can get city councils to change their, some of this is happening in various areas to change their purchasing policies. You can have people run eventually for some of these seats. I mean, one thing that's always struck me is that the UK, they have these like animal welfare policy briefs, the animal welfare agenda, I think it's called, that the major parties, including the Tories, they put one out where they list like, here's our policy position on all these relevant issues, like on confinement.
Yeah, the manifestos.
Mm. And in the US, like, we don't even exist as an issue for the for the Democratic Party, let alone the Republicans. I mean, it was last year that Biden's Solicitor General wrote he supported the pork industry in our Supreme Court case on Prop 12. And to me, this was like a very sobering wake-up call that not only are we not like influential with the Democratic Party, they wouldn't even think for a second that we exist, because we don't have a voting bloc. We're not part of their base. Like, we're not even an issue. We're not on the menu. So I think like a realistic, achievable goal could be like, how could we have a plank in these parties, or at least in the Democratic Party, of their position on at least some basic stuff like confinement. Like, we've banned confinement in you know, over 10 states now. Like, this seems like achievable. What about like testing cosmetics on animals, or, you know, fur? You know, there's probably some stretch stuff we could do. Like, this seems like a realistic goal. And it's just like, why, you know, we need to start organizing around this kind of stuff. We need to really have this power. We've gotten all these corporations to do it. We've done a great job with corporate campaigns in the private sector. And now it's time, I think, to capitalize on that and start, you know, if McDonald's can say that cages are on the way out, like, shouldn't the Democratic Party be able to say this?
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe, Annie, you might have a bit of a spicy take on this, but do you think, as allies, the kind of left-leaning or Democrat kind of groups is a much more clear, obvious ally? Or do you think we should be trying to be as bipartisan as possible? Or do you think that's just not realistic? Or, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a debate that comes up a lot around these questions of, like, what is the cost of becoming a kind of, like, left-coded cultural issue? And is it better to not fully engage with one part or the other? So it's very complicated. I mean, I think realistically... we are already a left-coded cultural issue. I mean, if you look at just like everything from Michelle Obama saying kids should eat more vegetables to, you know, we're going to have a veggie burger in a government building once a month, like the explosions that come from these things from the right, it is so clearly a left-coded issue to that faction that I think it's a little bit of wishful thinking that like there's this huge opportunity for us to become part of the like masculine right-wing identity in the US or something like this. On the other hand, I do think that avoiding where we can on many of our kind of like single issue campaigns we can run, there is no reason for it to become like a third rail cultural thing. So particularly around issues like confinement or slaughter or like cruel treatment of animals, I do think that there's just huge bipartisan support. So there's no reason for it to become I think it's more issues related to diet that I see as becoming extremely partisan very quickly and out of our control. So I do think that there's no need to kind of code things in one direction or the other on many of the issues we're on. And essentially because everyone agrees with us, you know, basically all the voters agree with us. Yeah. And speaking of Aiden and PaxFun, I know that they've done a lot of really interesting focus group work that relates to these. So I won't speak for them, but for those who are interested in learning more about this, there's a good amount of research that's coming out now. But I mean, look at the ballot initiatives we run. We get people from both parties to vote to ban cages in their states. You know, this is not like a super controversial issue.
Right. So I guess comparatively then to other movements, what do you think it is that we're missing? Is it just a timeline that we're just, you know, still such a new movement really in the grand scheme of things? Is it the level of resource? What do you think those key pieces are that we're missing comparatively?
I mean, those are definitely two factors. I think one reason that it has been slow to build is just a fundamental challenge kind of baked into what we're trying to do is that there's no natural organizing community that animal rights is based off of. You know, it's fully an ally-based movement, right? Like we're helping others. We're not advocating for ourselves or our own rights. And, you know, civil rights had the Black church in the United States. Same-sex marriage had just the kind of organic LGBT community that existed, especially in all these like major cities and important places around the country or around the world. We have what, like, I guess we have veganism has kind of been the communal principle, which is not, you know, this is like very weak compared to those other things. There isn't a place where we all organize in person. We don't do things where we have fun together in like a natural way. I mean, if you look at the civil rights movement, the church community would provide so much kind of cohesion and support and activity outside of just purely doing politics. If you look at the NRA and their success organizing the United States, you've seen the same thing. You know, for every one time the NRA is asking you to speak to your congressperson, they're engaging with you many times in other ways. You're going to gun shows, you're receiving magazines, they're helping build this identity, build this community where you have a sense of like, this is really who I am. And one thing that's being asked of me is doing this political work. And I think that we're either, you know, just based on diet, essentially, where this can be like where you expend your energy is like this project of personal purity and being more vegan and kind of like spreading that to other people, very consumer focused. And then you just have like the smaller group of people who are like the diehard activists, which is just not sustainable for most people and not attractive to most people. So I think to me, this is like the foundational challenge that we have is that we just don't, I mean, we have like vegan restaurants, right? This like, this sucks.
They're pretty good. All right. You back off. What do you think is alternative then? Are you thinking like vegan gun shows, vegan clubs, vegan unions? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Veganize everything. Or just like something for animal people is like, well, yeah, well, what does that actually look like? What would that kind of community hub actually look like, do you think?
Yeah, well, I wish I had a really good answer to this. I mean, I think that step one is kind of grappling with this problem and finding something. I think we need to start experimenting a bit more. I will say, going back to the local political stuff, I think this is something where you can build like a more sustainable kind of community. It's not too crazy of an ask for people, and it's you know, something that they can engage with as part of their normal life and still make a pretty big impact, and getting, you know, just getting people more involved on that local level. But it's a real challenge. I'm not exactly sure, to be honest. I mean, I think we could go a long way towards having more kind of exciting events and accessible events and conferences that people gather together in. I think that just getting the community together in a more and more accessible way is really important. And right now, just so much of what's done is targeted towards people like us who are all just, you know, just like die hard in the movement. You know, we know all the people. I think it's quite intimidating if you're just like a new random person to walk into that kind of space and feel like, how do I get involved without, you know, forsaking all of modern life and becoming one of these crazy people? I don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe like tangentially related to that is, I know you have this thing, maybe, do you think like, how tied do you think is like salary in organizations, something like this? Cause I think maybe we've had a previous chats a little bit about like, there's always a bit of like, oh, if you get paid so much, you're not really doing it for the animals, yada, yada, yada. But I think you've had some previous points. It's been like, well, we pay so much less compared to other kind of like social justice issues or like climate. And are we failing to attract the right people? Or just like a broad sweep of people, because we've traditionally either like try to, I don't know, depress salaries, not have that much funding, or yeah, do you have any thoughts on like, do you think this is like a barrier for people to get involved with the movement, or do you think like this isn't one of the bigger issues, or yeah, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it certainly is a barrier for people to get involved with it. There's no question about that like it's hard to hire people if your salaries are super, super low. I'm not gonna pretend like I have this is a complicated question that I don't have the perfect answer to, because there are real costs to like over professionalization and over, I don't know, like just having a few super large NGOs who are kind of like sclerotic and captured by the needs of the organization running everything. So like, you know, there's plenty of examples of movements or groups that have become like that. On the other hand, I think what needs to be avoided is among activists, this like valorization or martyrdom of like, if you're not sacrificing everything, you're not hardcore. You know, if you want to have any elements of like a normal life or comfort or happiness, then you're forgetting the suffering of the billions of animals. And that this is just too, like, the more we can do to lower the bar for involvement in the movement, like right now what we're asking people is, you know, you're going to make very little money, you're going to be vegan, you're going to be like constantly faced with these images and videos of suffering. And like, it's just all these things that are incredibly unappealing to people. And again, like look at the NRA, it's like, what are they focused on? Like, how do we make this as appealing and fun for our members? Like, how do we make this like a meaningful part of their life that they get a kick out of and enjoy and make friends through? And, you know, there's certainly argument. I'm not trying to just like trash the animal movement. There's a lot of incredible reasons to join. Like the reason that all of us are here is like the all the positive parts of it. But I think, you know, we need to, as strategists, grapple more with like, how do we lower the bar for involvement and really get away from this like puritanical thinking that so many people in the movement are obsessed with, where it's just like the anxiety that I'm sure you two have experienced this. You meet people who just started working at a group or volunteering at a group. The anxiety people feel about being like found out, like, oh, I still have these leather shoes and I wore them to this event because I got them before I went vegan. And like, so like, I've heard so many stories like this is insane. Like, this is not a good way to operate.
Mm. Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like I have a funny anecdote from that. I think I'd done like a couple of years of animal rights activism with the groups like Anonymous the Voiceless, like the classic vegan outreach, all that good stuff. And then I remember, yeah, it's all very serious. People all wearing dark clothes, all wearing black, watching sad footage. It's pretty intense. And then I remember going to one of my first climate protests in the UK with Extinction Rebellion and just being like, wow, people are like happy and smiling and like having a good time. Like, whoa, this is like crazy. Like, you can actually do activism and care about political issues and not be like sad. I was like, oh. So yeah, I would love some more of that if we could. Yeah, because if people stick around for the social relationships, you join for the issues, but you stick around because you meet great people, you're actually having a good time, you form meaningful relationships. And yeah, I think we need to have that kind of offering, as well as the importance of the moral issue, which is obviously super important, which is, yeah, we wouldn't be here in the first place if it wasn't for that. Maybe I'll pick up on a book recommendation that you gave me, Dave, like maybe a few months ago. I don't know if you remember, I asked for a few book recommendations and you said Engines of Liberty, which I'm actually reading. I'm about like a third of the way through. It's a great book. But maybe do you want to say what are some cool takeaways for you from that book, or what it's about, and just why you think it's relevant to the animal rights movement?
Yeah. I highly recommend it to all activists to check out. It's just very inspirational. It's an easy read as well. It's definitely written in a pretty engaging way. So it's a history book that covers the fight for same-sex marriage in the U.S., the shift in gun rights in the U.S., as well as a fight over torture in the United States. So kind of three different activist movements that were successful in changing the Constitution or the way the Constitution was viewed. And in particular, the sections on the NRA and gun rights and the fight for same-sex marriage, I found to be really inspirational in that, like, the shift in public opinion on these issues was so rapid and so complete. Just like everyone thinks one thing, and then a few decades later, everyone thinks the other thing, and it's politically unfashionable to think the old thing. So for people like us working on a what is essentially a fringe issue like animal rights, like, this is inspirational stuff. It also encouraged me to read the history book that came out recently by a journalist called Sasha Eisenberg called The Engagement, about same-sex marriage. So for folks looking for a kind of deep dive on that, it's a very long and dense history book. It's a great read, but it covers like every little detail of the fight for same-sex marriage, both sides in the United States. It is one of my favorite all-time books now, for sure. So it's a must read. So some of the lessons that I think from that book that stuck with me, and I'll be curious to hear, James, like what you're thinking so far. But I think when it comes to, the things I mentioned with the NRA, the use of local activists to get these kind of small, almost symbolic political wins at the early stage of their project and building that up over time into kind of cascading larger political victories, I thought was a very interesting approach, where these activists really developed a lot of skills and influence over time. And that was paired with this really shrewd long-term legal strategy, where they would have scholars go into law schools and start lecturing, promoting what was essentially then a very fringe point of view on the interpretation of the Second Amendment. I mean, if you talk to, at least what the book says is, if you talk to conservative legal scholars back then when this project was starting, even pretty right-wing scholars would say, like, oh yeah, the Second Amendment is really meant for, you know, local militias and so on, and it's not super relevant to, you know, like consumer gun culture and so on. And now they've just completely shifted through this approach of going into law schools and converting all the young people to this way of thinking. Like, no, actually, this is an amendment that should be interpreted very broadly, that, you know, all sorts of guns are allowed and so on. And they've just, through this kind of targeted education, lecturing, focus on students, completely shifted a generational point of view. So I think that this is a really, really interesting strategy that animal people should consider. And I'm actually pretty excited about all the law schools where we have a lot of great education going on now. But beyond that, I think like we could do more with students generally. So yeah, those are two parts from the NRA section that I really took a lot from.
Mm. Maybe one thing I'll pick up on that. So on the first point you were making, it was something like the NRA were doing things to basically just get wins, rather than like, they didn't think, oh, maybe achieving some particular policy was like the best way to have, I don't know what the gun policies are in the UK, just like the ability to carry weapons openly, yada, yada, yada. But they were just doing things just like build momentum, both like internally and build power and just like kind of have wins. Is that kind of like the thesis of just like, you do things as like stepping stones, even though it's not like the most important thing for your issue?
Well, so if I'm remembering, yeah, I haven't read this book in a few years, but if I'm remembering correctly, some of the early projects that they had were having like super local volunteers change kind of citywide restrictions on what kind of handguns were allowed or something, where this is not like at the end of the day, a massive win. But over time, you start chipping away. I think in the animal movement, there could be a lot of analogs here, like the fur bans, I think, are a great example. Where right now, if you were to ask, like, how do we ban fur in the United States? Like, ban the production and sale of fur. It's a tall order. I don't know. It's very challenging. But you could imagine a world where, like, okay, how do we ban fur in, like, the 50 largest cities in the United States? Then all of a sudden, you know, that's an interesting question. That's something you could actually sit down and, like, get a Google Doc going and really think about, maybe actually get into like 40 out of 50 in the coming years. And then all of a sudden you're a lot closer to like banning it in a number of states, getting closer to that federal action. And like that kind of mindset, I think, would be quite useful, that really long-term planning. And frankly, you saw a lot of this with the same-sex marriage fight as well, of like, how are we going to run the table on all the states? And I think that that's something that I'd love to see more of. I mean, it's something that's been happening on the cage-free law, certainly. And we're starting to see with some citywide regulations, but it's just the animal movement traditionally is not engaged a lot with that kind of long-term political thinking, at least as a cohesive coalition. I'm sure many individuals or individual groups have.
Do you think there's other tactics that we could also explore? I think we touched on before, like, you're excited to see a diversification of tactics. Do you feel like there's anything else we can pull on within this movement that you'd be excited to see more of? Or is it just generally the act of diversification?
I mean, some of the areas where I think we are not doing quite enough experimentation is around kind of like media and public persuasion. I think one unfortunate thing that happened among the, like, I don't know, the pragmatist side of the movement, or whatever we're going to call it now, was that there was this, over the last 10 years, a real shift towards institutional work. Like, okay, we have been trying the kind of vegan outreach advocacy side of things for so many years. The numbers game isn't working. We're not seeing the huge uptick. Let's focus on these incremental reforms at institutions. Now, obviously, I think that that's like a key pillar of what we should be doing. But I do feel like we threw the baby out with the bathwater a little bit. Like, you know, persuading people of things is still really good. It's still a good thing to do. And just because we might not want to be just like using all of our time handing out booklets anymore, I do think that we haven't done enough experimentation with all sorts of public persuasion. I mean, for starters, like, the movement just isn't terribly sophisticated in our media outreach. Like, I think we have an issue that there's a lot of opportunity out there for media coverage that we're leaving on the table because we just aren't spending enough time experimenting. And so there's plenty of groups that have done things that have gotten awesome coverage in the last few years. But to me, this is almost just proof of like, yeah, this is possible. This could be a winning issue and we need to devote more time. And there's a lot of things within that realm of kind of public persuasion. It's not really my expertise, so I don't have like a kind of ready to go plan, but it's just an area where clearly we could be doing more, I think. And I wish that we were doing more.
Mm. What do you think is holding that back? Why do you think we're not doing more? Is it just like funding isn't there for it, or just like we don't have the talent, or yeah? What do you think that bottleneck is?
I mean, it's probably just like an area that hasn't grown enough yet. Don't get me wrong. Listen, there's people who, like, DXC is a great example of a group that gets a ton of media coverage and without too much funding either. So I certainly don't mean to say that it isn't happening at all. But I do think that it would be good for more funding. And I guess just more than funding, just like the interest of activists coming into the space to get more involved in working on media, coming up with media pitches, crafting stories for media. And again, like, this is just a component of like an overall strategy. So to me, the dream is like the grassroots are doing actions and investigations that can get a lot of media coverage, and that this is like dovetailing with a, I don't know, state ballot initiative effort or something. Like, you can imagine a world where it's like the component pieces are creating something that as a whole is greater than just the parts put together. So to me, that would be like the really, really sweet element.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some good opportunity for like this inside outside game collaboration, whether it's like, yeah, people doing investigations and the more grassroots stuff, and then yeah, the corporate campaigns. So, yeah. And I want to pick up on one thing you said, which was, I don't know, I have this like hunch where reason why maybe we went away or like we're still not doing much of the media stuff is that it's just really hard to measure, right? It's just really hard to know how useful loads of press coverage, like a documentary, like a TV show about a particular issue is. And I think, especially within maybe more like pragmatic, maybe you might want to say more like effective altruist leaning people, like obviously there's a big focus there on like measurability. And do you think that's one thing that's holding back the media service? Because it's like hard to gauge exactly how well it is. And corporate campaigns have a really good track record of like actually averting quite huge numbers of chicken years of suffering per dollar. So yeah, do you think that's a component in this?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, like when I'm talking to the more like EA minded or whatever you want to call it folks, I'm often very kind of frustrated that the measurability bias that comes out, where it's like a lot of the strategic thinking to me is so bounded by what is measurable and how do we compare that to these kind of like safe bets, like a where we can really get a sense of like how many animals are impacted. And then on the other hand, when I talk to folks who are outside of that world, it's the opposite response of like, well, how are we going to measure this? And how are we going to have any sense of whether it's working? So I think we really need a balance. And I think what I'd like to see is definitely more open-mindedness from the metric heads. And then,
well, this is the new debate. Forget about wealth versus abolitionists. Yeah, exactly. Metric heads and hate data.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, for the other folks, I think what happens is the reaction of some of the people who are, yeah, like in the other camp of like the kind of anti-EA camp that you would see, instead just a total rejection of the premise. Like to me, the essential contribution of EA in general, but especially to the animal movement, is just this like this harsh reality that most charities and most campaigns are incredibly ineffective, and that some of them are just like 1,000 times more effective than others. And I think that this kind of pearl of wisdom is something that we should not lose sight of. So it doesn't mean that we should have like a totalizing obsession with a spreadsheet that tells us exactly what to do at all times, and like all resources go towards that one thing on the spreadsheet. But instead, I think we need to increase the level of rigor of like, okay, this is an experimental campaign, but like, here are the leading indicators of success. Here are the things we can measure. Like if this is a campaign focused on getting media, sure, it's really hard to tell like how many hearts and minds have we changed, but you can tell if something's working or it's not in other ways. So I think like, it's about a mindset of like commitment to measurement. And also I think setting out goals of like, this will have been successful if, you know, X, Y, and Z things happen. If that doesn't happen, saying like, okay, let's try something else. What you always see instead is like the inertia becomes the main element in like what decides next year's strategy. It's like, okay, well, we'll keep doing this thing and we'll grow it incrementally by 10%, no matter what. That's kind of like the status quo, unless someone is there kind of like grabbing you by the shoulders and shaking and yelling in your face, like you need to decide if this is really working.
Yeah, I do find it funny that like on the measurability bias, I've literally had people be like, if it's not measurable, I don't care about it. And this is like, what? But also you can't go too far the other way as well. I think, like you were saying, I think like most things, a balance is good. And yeah, for me, it's just like, I would just be so surprised if all the best things were measurable. Like that just seems so convenient to that worldview. And I just don't think the world is that straightforward, but maybe I'll be wrong. Who knows?
Well, I guess one thing I'll add here, one thought I've had in the last year talking a lot to advocates about this topic is that I think there's this misapplication of the EA mindset to animals, where I think where they got started with global development and health. I think it makes a lot of sense to have this measurement and maximizing mindset, because they're stepping into essentially an industry with thousands of nonprofits and hundreds of governments involved and the UN, where it's just like an endless amount of resources and people and researchers involved in this project. And in that environment, you should be doing this kind of maximizing thing where you're like, okay, well, there's 10,000 options. What are the best three? And how do we get money to them? Because everything else is funded. And like, we're just trying to like on the margin have some impact. But this is a totally different context than the animal movement, which is quite nascent, where we're still kind of stumbling around in the dark. Like we've discovered a few things that seem to be working, but the idea that that's what we should be doing in, I don't know, 15 years is totally not persuasive. Like we might be doing something totally different, or we should be doing 10 other things that are different. And like the idea that the first thing we discovered will forever be the best thing and that we should never experiment again is just very different than stepping into an industry that's been around forever and has tried everything. So I think that there needs to be a kind of different modes that we, different lenses we look at different contexts through. And I think the animal movement, we need to have a little bit more of an exploratory mindset. I think obviously we need to keep doing the things that are working for sure, but not at the expense of trying out other stuff. And I think that like, this is where measurability bias can really bite us.
Yeah, I think one last point on this topic is that, yeah, I just looked it up because I thought I knew this. So the global health and development like movement spend $3.5 billion on R&D every year. And for context, the animal movement spends about 200 million kind of overall. So that's like 5%. We're 5% of their R&D budget. So like they just have so much more research and knowledge information out there to actually like know what's working. And we have nothing, basically. We have, we're working on a shoestring. So yeah, it'd be very surprised if we can do the exact same thing they're doing. Funnily enough, Amy, you used to co-direct Animal Ask, so doing lots of animal research. Like, did you factor this into your work there, like measurability bias? Like, do you think you just did what was measurable because it was easy to do research on?
Yeah, I still think, I mean, you know, it's only been functioning for like 2.5 years. So I still think that's really difficult because even in the research that we suggested organizations use to inform their campaigns, those campaigns are still ongoing, right? So I think that was a challenge for us that within the EA space, you know, the say funders, for example, are looking for the measurements. Well, how did we influence the campaigns? How did we change animal lives? And actually, you know, it's just a much longer timeline there. So I definitely think that has, contributed to feeling, you know, sometimes like we're not contributing when actually we know that is the case. It's just really difficult to prove. I definitely recognize that sense of, maybe holding too much to the metrics and not enough just knowing and trusting that what we're doing is supporting the movement with this research resource that doesn't exist. And actually we have seen, you know, campaigns or interventions in practice that have a detrimental impact. And so just knowing that we're ending those at least, or trying to, by, you know, making sure that organizations are taking, you know, research into account before starting a campaign, I think, you know, could be proof enough for now until we have those, you know, some figures to go off when the campaigns are coming to a close and we can really measure the impact that that's had.
Nice. Yeah. Maybe plug to, I think, Animal International, who I think stopped one of their campaigns in Poland, the live carp campaign, because they thought it actually might be harming more fish than it was saving. But there's lots on that on the EA forum if you want to check it out. So yeah, it's a good post. Maybe another controversial one, Dave. What's a view you hold that most animal advocates you think would disagree with? And it can be one you've already said. So you got to think, Cardi. You can't do that same measurability or the same political stuff. It's going to be something spicy.
Okay. Yeah, that was going to be my easy answer, as I've probably named a bunch of them already. Well, I guess, I don't know if this counts as a doubling down on something. But in general, like I'm very skeptical and pretty negative about veganism as an idea and principle to found the movement on. I just think that it's a really, and this is something I guess Wayne from DXE wrote about many years ago that I've really come around to, that I do think that has been, I don't know what a better alternative is beyond just caring about animals. But I think that has been a real, it's been,
Do you think it's been like harmful overall? Do you think it's like been made us focus too much on like food and consumption and identity? Or yeah, do you think things are actually harmful or just like not the best?
I think it's really because it's essentially built around this concept of personal purity that adds this kind of like fundamentalist religious element to this like foundational piece of the identity that I think is quite unhelpful. And when I just, there's just something missing to me where so many people are sympathetic. So many people are sympathetic to our cause and generally agree with most of our like political project, what we're trying to achieve. At least the first, you know, the first many steps, people are really on board with us. And just the number of people who would never get on board because of veganism. I mean, this is just a huge gap to me. It's something we need to address. So I don't know exactly what the solution is, but this is something I've been thinking more and more about, like this need for community, this need for stronger social organization, and just the weakness of veganism as this thing that most people see as, you hear from people like who would critique this point of view, like, oh, it's actually really easy to be vegan and beans are cheap and all these things. But like, this is just not realistic for most people. Like if you talk to non-vegans, like that is just not how they view things. And this is a real challenge. And I think like, we're just leaving so much power on the table by having this small tent. Now, obviously like I'm vegan, so
that would be controversial if you weren't. Wow. That would be
yeah. But
spicy take.
Yeah, I guess that for me is something I've really been thinking about a lot in the last year as one of these core problems.
Yeah, I was thinking, how much smaller would the climate movement be if you couldn't be part of it? If you flew, had a car, ate red meat, basically did like so many things, it would be probably much smaller, much less politically active and like serious relative to what it is now. But there's no clear defining line. If you care about climate change, you're in.
Like, what if you couldn't, you know, support labor unions if you ordered from Amazon? You know, like, it's a really high level of demandingness.
There was an interesting conversation recently about organizations and actually hiring, whether you have to hire vegans, right, in the movement, and if not doing so. So maybe we could fill a talent bottleneck if we hired from, you know, outside, people who are just sympathetic to the cause, but maybe, you know, not as, I don't know, not vegan. I don't want to say not as committed, because I think that goes against the arguments we've just made. But yeah, do you feel like at THL, was there ever a sense of, you know, this kind of like mission drift? Do you think there's risk in opening the movement up to that?
Well, I think that, you know, there's definitely a gap here. I'm less concerned about professional people working in the movement. My guess is like most of those people are probably going to be vegan. And if they don't, if they're hired when they're not vegan, they'll often become vegan very quickly. Like, I think that is just such a strong part of the culture and all the groups that seems less relevant to me than like people who might consider themselves like an animal activist or part of the animal movement generally. Like, that to me is really the crux of the issue, is like, what is the, for everyone to feel comfortable, like, oh yeah, this person's part of the team, what is the threshold they have to cross? That to me is really what I'm interested in, because I think there's always going to be that core hardcore cadre of people, and they're going to have a really intense level of commitment. But, you know, for like people, James, to your point, like, who might say like, oh yeah, like, I'm an environmentalist, like, what, you know, you don't want to totally water it down, because for a lot of people that probably means almost nothing. But like, I think we can afford to move a little bit more in that direction, of like letting people feel like part of their identity is like, oh, I'm a voter who cares about animals, and I'm always going to vote in their defense, even if they're not like fully on board in all the ways that we wish they were. Like, that to me is where I think we could expand the tent quite a bit. I certainly don't, I'm not saying like, you know, strategic leadership of the movement should really be like watered down.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. The bar's pretty high.
What's one positive bit of news in the animal world you're excited about or you're grateful to hear?
Let's see. Well, I guess, recently the milestone reached by the Open Wing Alliance of the 3,000 corporate victories achieved around the world. I mean, it's just like that personally was very exciting and gratifying and awesome to see. And I think even if you're someone who's not super excited about those campaigns as a strategy, what it does show is the power of a coalition of groups coming together and sharing resources, and where like a little bit of resources can go such a long way, and where like this is just an achievement in terms of like, this is a major project that animal people took on together and have been really successful in, and it's created, I think, a lot of feelings of camaraderie across the movement, this kind of culture of sharing and succeeding together. So to me, that kind of thing is super exciting. It's been great seeing in New York the hospital system as well has, you know, dramatically decreased their meat served and greatly increased like plant-based options. That to me is a great example of the kind of local political achievements that we can think about in the near term future as like a kind of like a high watermark right now of a really great policy. Those are two things that immediately come to mind.
Nice. And there's those out there because 3,000 wins is pretty crazy. I think even just having a coalition that's so big and functioning and isn't a total nightmare in terms of everything, I think it's very impressive. Like that alone, just like surviving, it is pretty good for a big coalition. But I think having 3,000 wins is, pretty remarkable. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, nice. And then we've talked about the Engines of Liberty and a couple of other resources, but is there anything else, any recommendations for listeners? So books, blog posts, podcasts, anything that's particularly inspired your journey?
Let's see. Well, I mentioned the engagement. That's a super high recommendation on same-sex marriage. I really recommend this group called How Organizations Develop Leaders by a researcher named Hari Han, I think is how you pronounce her name. And it's a very data-driven research book on what the title says, how organizations develop leaders. And it looks at a lot of different grassroots groups and NGOs of different sizes. And it just categorizes the different ways that activists develop skills. So, you know, there's like the lone wolf model, kind of rock star person doing their own thing. How do they develop skills? Or the people who, you know, have more traditional management-based models and so on. And she just goes step by step explaining in great detail how effective these things are. And for anyone who works with volunteers, or if their org works with volunteers, this is like a must read. It's just such a goldmine of information. It's so practical. So that one I'm really excited about.
I will throw a small correction. It's actually called How Organizations Develop Activists, not Leaders. But I agree. I've read it. It's a great book. So I also recommend
it. It's awesome.
That. Sorry. Yeah. Keep going.
Another book that I only stumbled across, like, I don't know, 2 years ago. It's an older book. I don't know when it's from, but it's certainly before I got started in the movement, I think. It's called Get Political for Animals and Win the Laws They Need by Julie E. Lewis. And it is just, it's like a textbook basically that step by step tells you exactly how to do all the political organizing stuff I was talking about before. It explains like all the levels of government you need to know, everything you need to do, what the strategy should be. I mean, it's like, it's unbelievable. And as many activists as possible should own this book in the animal movement. I think it's just an incredible resource that exists. So that's another winner. And outside of that, I'll say I love reading history books generally, either like biographies or history of other social movements or important moments in history. They're just always incredible lessons. And I think getting perspective outside of our little world is really good and useful just for thinking about problems.
Nice.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's good, inspiring three books to read. So yeah, thanks, Dave, for coming on the podcast. Our first guest, very exciting. yeah, so thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's a blast chatting with you guys. And I'm looking forward to hearing more episodes.